Okay.
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome live on Tribe Family Channel 2, Voices of Wisdom, hosted by the civil rights activists of the Tuvalu Nine. I am Beverly Black, and I'm the creator of Tribe Family Channel, a Gumbo for the Soul international family brand. Tribe Family Channel, Voices of Wisdom, Final Season 10, Episode 3, hosted by civil rights activists of the historic Tugulu Nine, Mrs. Geraldine Hollis and Mr. Joseph Jackson Jr., the leader of the Tugulu Nine, who was trained by Megar Evers. Now, today's guest speaker is Mr. Charles Wright. He is the founder of the Watts 103rd Street Rhythm Band and the author of Up, From Where We've Come. The topic today is our Mississippi roots and what ravaged us. This conversation is going to be very deep. So first, let me set the tone about the Tugulu Nine. At 11 a.m. on March 27, 1961, nine students from the historically black Tugulu College walked into the all-white Jackson, Mississippi Public Library. Joseph Jackson Jr., their leader, approached the circulation desk. If you go on Wikipedia, it says that the Tougaloo Nine were a group of African-American students at Tougaloo College who participated in civil disobedience by staging sit-ins at segregated public institutions in Mississippi in 1961. I beg to differ that it was a read-in. They were there to check out books, and they had every right to as students of the very college where that library sat. But we don't have to take Wikipedia's word for it, because we have the leader of the Tougaloo Nine right here as I co-host instead for Mrs. Geraldine Hollis, who is away traveling. I welcome Mr. Joseph Jackson Jr. Hello, Mr. Jackson. How are you?
Well, hello there, Mrs. Black. I am fine. Thank you for that great introduction regarding the history of the Tougaloo Nine, who were participants in breaking down the Jim Crow barriers of segregation. And I do believe that was the state in which Mr. Wright was born and came from up out of there and become a success. So actually, you know, we're connecting the dots. You know what I mean? And so
absolutely, I know exactly what you mean. Well, let's bring on Mr. Wright. You know, you brought him up. So let me tell our guests, our audience about Mr. Wright and set the tone, because I'm looking forward to this conversation. I want you and this gentleman to take it away, because your roots run deep. Now, Charles Wright was born in Clarksdale, Mississippi, where he grew up and was musically inclined by playing the guitar and singing in several doo-wop groups, including the Twilighters, the Shield, and the Callahads. Wright briefly worked as an A&R director for Delphi Records and was responsible for the hit recording of Those Oldies But Goodies Remind Me of You by Little Caesar and the Romans in 1961. Now, that's the same year of the Tougaloo Nine Mississippi Library sit-in. So now, by 1964, though, Mr. Wright had formed his own band called Charles Wright and the Wright Sounds, which included John Rainford and Durrell Dragon, the captain of Captain and Tennille. Now, he, like I said in the beginning, is the founder of the Watts 103rd Street Rhythm Band, and he is the author of Up From Where We've Come. Ladies and gentlemen, live on Voices of Wisdom, hosted by the Tougaloo Nine, it is an honor, a privilege, and a pleasure to introduce the civil rights activists of the historic Tougaloo Nine to the founder of the Watts 103rd Street Rhythm Band, and I might as well say historic too, because that's where the funk found its roots. Mr. Charles Wright, good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening, Mr. Wright.
Hello, Brother Jackson. How are you doing?
Oh, man. As I was trying to say to you before we had to be interrupted with the music of the program, but as I said, it's really an honor for me to be able to talk with you, because I'm retired now, but it was your hit a record, Express Yourself, that I would play when I was working in Juvenile Hall in Downey, California, at Los Padrinos, and I would always bring my soul music with me to really tame the youngsters, and that was one of their favorite funk rhythmic songs. And so now here I am. I'm talking with the man who really played a great role when I was working with the juveniles there in down in California. And I'm just really, that's why I'm on it. Because, man, I put your funk on, boy, and that was it. And I would always play it when they would have had their showers and then they're in their rooms and just prior to the lights going out, I would put on the funk.
You're giving me goose pimples. You're giving me goose pimples. You left here with I say you're giving me goose pimples.
Well, when Miss Black told me who the guest was going to be on Thursday, she spoke with me, I think it was Monday or Tuesday, to let me know who the guest would be. And she mentioned your name. I've been playing Express Yourself right on up just before we went to air. So when she mentioned your name, when she mentioned your name and by you being a native Mississippian, I got goose temples then at that time, Mr. Wright.
All right.
Wow. Well, now wait until you hear Mr. Wright's story. This story is something else. I'm holding an autographed copy of Up From Where We've Come. Such a handsome, charming gentleman on the front cover. And it says, Up From Where We've Come, Charles Wright, An Eventful Journey. Now, Mr. Wright, Express Yourself has been in over 50 commercials, 30 movies, and continues on. But I think your greatest work is your autobiography. It says that you have weaved a story of yourself as a young man in the cotton fields of Mississippi during World War II amid high racial tensions. The social injustice of the Deep South had a profound effect on Charles and his family's lifestyle, which Charles expresses in this book. Now, it's full of thrilling stories, romance, drama, and action. It's the true story of your family's trials and tribulations on a cotton plantation owned by a cruel sharecropping shyster named Edward Miles. And I'm going to say that again, a cruel sharecropping shyster named Edward Miles. I love it when we tell our stories and name names. I published a book by a sharecropper's family, and she was out of Battle, Mississippi. Battle, Mississippi was named after her family. And they were sharecroppers, and they were tricked to give 4 years of free labor. You know, with that cycle of you didn't produce enough crop this year to pay your wages and to get out of here. So now it continues to say that Edward was born with an unfair advantage, which he uses as a wedge to dominate his subjects. At a critical time in Charles's life, at the age of 8, Charles's father demanded he pick 100 pounds of cotton daily or face vicious whippings. Now, I'm going to say that again. At a critical time in his life, at age 8, Charles's father demanded he pick 100 pounds of cotton daily or face vicious whoopings. Ladies and gentlemen, on Tribe Family Channel, you are about to hear a conversation between two gentlemen. One gentleman is the leader that led a group of individuals to desegregate the library system, of which I got my start in publishing many years later in 2005. But in 1961, when I was yet 2 years old, black people couldn't be in the library. And had it not been for the Tougaloo Nine, we wouldn't be in there now. We also have joining Mr. Joseph Jackson Jr., Mr. Charles Wright. Mr. Charles Wright comes from a family of sharecroppers. He picked cotton. Do you understand that the T-shirts on your back and the sheets on your bed go deep down into the roots of the labor of our people, and this man has felt the prickly thorns of cotton picking on his fingertips and had to be under the pressure of the oppression of his father's oppressor, who was given dealing out the oppression to pick 100 bales of cotton a day. Mr. Charles Wright, I hand you over to Mr. Joseph Jackson, and I will be right here listening to this dialogue. I want you to tell us your story and why you've come to the moment like this, and Mr. Jackson will respond. Gentlemen, enjoy.
Yes, well, Mr. Wright, I can really feel the energy, even though I haven't read your autobiography, but just the title of it, up from here.
Well, I always say the title could have a question mark behind it. Up from where we've come, we ain't going too far from there, really.
Okay. You want to elaborate on that? Because I can relate to the title, because even though you were born there in Clarksville, Mississippi, and you came from up out of that system and found your way finally, out here in California. And with me, I came from up out of the same system in a city known as Memphis, Tennessee. Not far from Clarksdale. And I came from up out of there February of 1968. And when I arrived here in California, that was the time of Dr. King's visit in support of the sanitation worker strike. And to find out that he was assassinated in my city. But enough about me, but we have that title in common from where we came from, because we both came from up out of a Jim Crow system.
Yeah, now, I went back there last year. I really haven't been back too often since I left. I went back in 1990 to bury my last uncle down there, and I went back again. I went back again last year, and I went back one time between that just to take my wife and daughter to see what it was about. And today they treat you so nice, but it ain't real.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can tell it's not for real. You know, their temperament is not too far from going off still. I didn't come from Clarksdale. I came from the cotton patch 9 miles out of Clarksdale.
So you definitely wanted to get that out there to the listeners, to let them know that you didn't come from Clarksdale, but 9 miles out from Clarksdale. Is that right?
In the middle of the cotton patch.
Absolutely. Oh, my God. Well, now, although you were 9 miles outside of Clarksdale, still that was considered to have still to have been Clarksdale proper, right? The city of Clarksdale, or am I really reading too much into history? Because, I don't know that much about, that part of Mississippi. Now, was that another city, or was that still considered the city of Clarksdale, Mississippi?
But it was 9 miles away from Clarksdale. As a matter of fact, I came from a place called Matson. They had one service station, which was a grocery store at the same time, and a church. or two, and that's about it.
And what was the name? I didn't quite get that.
Matson.
Matson?
Matson, M-A-T-S-O-N.
Matson.
Yeah.
Matson? Oh, that's the name for me. Okay. And so, what about your family? You know, your brothers and your sisters. In terms of, you know, your father, your parents being sharecroppers there in Matson, Mississippi. Are you the oldest? Where are you?
I'm number
in
seven.
I'm
number seven.
You're number seven?
Seven out of 14.
Seven out of how many?
14.
Like 1 4?
14.
Like 1 4, 14. He said like 1 4. Yes, he's 7 out of 14. You know, in the South,
big family.
Nights were cold. Nights were cold. Come on now.
Yeah, it was, but that's why they. My father, that was his best asset. He had a big family. Pick a lot of cotton.
Lord, have
mercy. Yeah.
Well, it's
did you live that kind of lifestyle before you decided, you know, to get from up out of there?
My plan was, since I was six, the first day I went to the cotton patch, my plan was to run away and go to St. Louis or Chicago. But,
you had those plans at the age of six?
Yes, sir. if you read my book, you'll understand that. But anyway, I was... planning to do that, but my mother, my oldest sister and her boyfriend, they ran off to California. So they invited my mother to come out to California in 1949. She came to California, and when she came back, she would never be happy again in the cotton patch where we were. She always threatened my father. She was going, if he didn't do something, she was going to take the female children and leave and come back to California. And, and eventually, that's what she did. And we followed my father. And it was two of my brothers and I were left. And so we came out later to join my mother about 6 months after she came out here. And so that's how I got to California.
How old were you when you came to California?
12 years old.
12, okay. So, and how old were you when she left?
I was 11. I was 12.
11 when she left, okay. Okay, so she hadn't been gone that long. So during when you were eight, picking 100 bales of cotton a day, was that applied to all of?
100 pounds of cotton, honey. No.
I'm sorry, 100 pounds of cotton a day.
Yeah.
was this applied to all of your siblings? Because this is we're talking about something so.
Yes, it was.
So cruel and so such a punishment in life coming up through that era, you know, it's almost hard to comprehend, you know, the laughter is not about humor, but it's really about this being a story beyond comprehension, because we've never had anybody on the show that could explain to the depth that you're about to go. So I want you to take me back to that 8-year-old little boy. What is your earliest remembrance of, and just describe it to us as best you can without giving away the details of the book. And ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Charles Wright, our guest on Voices of Wisdom, his book, Up From Where We've Come. This man was a sharecropper in Mississippi. Mr. Charles Wright, that 8-year-old boy, what was his... Well, you were going to run away at 6. You had formulated the plans. So take us back to before you made the plans. Take us back to that era. I mean, because that's pretty deep right there.
Well, you know, when I was, if you read my book, you'll understand it. But when I was, before I became 6 years old, I was big. My father, my brother, I had to babysit my brother who was 2 years younger than me, while my family went off to the cotton patch. And I was always begging, please take me to the cotton patch too. But they wouldn't. My father, no, you're not old enough. And finally, when I got 6 years old, he broke it to me that he was taking me to the cotton patch. Man, was I happy. And I went out there. The first day I went out there, after about 30 minutes, I realized this is the worst thing I could have ever imagined.
You just wanted to go outside as a little child. You felt like you were doing labor at home babysitting. You know, you got cabin fever. You in the house babysitting. You want to go outside in the air. You're a kid, and you think there's going
to
be some play.
They want to be with the family, too, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was the worst thing that happened to me. Now, I have a sister. Her name is Jessie Mae. She's 4 years older than me. Jessie Mae could pick 250 pounds of cotton when I went out there.
Ooh.
When my father was eight, he was demanding 100 pounds from me. She was doing 250 pounds. Skinniest thing in the family. She could pick
Ooh.
More than my
Lord, have mercy.
Wow.
Them hands was in and out. He said she was the skinniest thing in the family. She was swift like a gazelle. She was handling her business. Lord.
That was the system with regards to how many pounds of cotton each sibling could pick, because the more pounds of cotton that you could pick, then that money would not only be earned by your brothers and sisters, that money would just bypass the hands of your father and the person that received the dividends of you picking cotton and your father, you know, pressuring you to pick more cotton. All of that went to the owner of the plantation. Am I right?
It wasn't in terms of dollars as much as it was a poundage. It was, we had 40 acres that we had.
And no mule.
We had two mules. We had 40 acres.
Okay, all right.
We had 40 acres. And we would have to work that 40 acres before, like, Thanksgiving time. So that was a lot of pressure on my father. And he transferred it down to us, of course. And I'm telling you, I never did get that 100 pounds. I got whooping every day.
Mm-hmm.
I could not get
it. Oh, Mr. Wright.
So now let me ask you something, because when you talk and speak in terms of a system that uses human capital for gain, such as sharecropping, one step out of slavery is just about the same, because you go through that revolving system of not making enough crop to buy and cover your family's labor and upkeep for being there, hence the term sharecropping. The crop that you bring in would cover your room and board being there on the land with the roof over your heads, and oftentimes families would also plant beside where they lived a garden so that they could eat. So we already know that there was this system in place that took advantage of the human capital of our people, but it was also a system within a system where they would never come out fair, where they would never break even or even surpass what their gross needed to be in order to get out from under that thumb. So can you expound on that, if your family went through that cycle of, because I've published a book about a family that went through 4 years of that cycle, and the father continued to plant alongside the sharecropper's portion until he was able to amass enough wealth to get out of there, and they had to push their push their truck uphill in the dark to get out of away from there.
Yeah, well, we had my father had a 50-50 agreement with the owner of the land. Okay, and every year, at the end of the year, my father would sit down in his car, which he called his office, and they would discuss their differences. Only twice in 23 years, we came close to even. We never could get above even. So every year he found some way to get us to where we could not break even. And my father had to borrow money on next year's crop. And so perpetually we kept falling deeper and deeper into a hole.
Right. Now, how are you able, you and your family, really to finally, I know your mother really, you know, when she came to California, you know, and discovered, I would say, you know, California, you know, the land of paradise. But how was it that your father really was allowed to up and leave the plantation? Did he square everything away financially with the plantation owner before he left, or did he just decide, I'm out of here? You know, how did that work out?
You know, we worked for that man, Mr. Miles, for, like I said, my parents worked for him for almost 23 years. And then we got involved.
Wow.
We got involved with another man who happened, we didn't know it was his cousin. We thought we was getting away from him. And he had the worst situation. His situation.
Oh, Lord.
His situation was twice as bad as Mr. Miles. So when we finally got out of that situation, we moved into town. And
with Clarksville?
Yeah, and they was trying to force my father. My father couldn't get work. He couldn't get a job. My mother had found a job in a laundromat for $9.50 a week. And I had a job on a dry cleaning truck for $12.50 a week. We thought we'd have a $72 a month allowance from my brother, who had just been inducted into the Army, but the city officials wouldn't allow them to get that. My mother wrote President Roosevelt. He responded in kind, but they still couldn't get that money. So we were stuck with my $12.50, my mother's $9.50, and which was enough to get by until till one day my mother came home and said, I'm out of here, and packed her clothes. Police was following her all the way home, talking about all under her clothes and stuff. So she just stormed in the house and said, I'm out of here. And she started packing her clothes. Yeah.
And later on, your father and you and your brothers followed your mother afterwards?
Yes, sir.
Wow.
We, 6 months later, I think it was about that, we came to California.
Well, now, when did you really realize that you were passionate about music? Because early on, you know, when Ms. Black, you know, was mentioning Clarksville, and then, you know, later on you was an R man, I'm sure you were aware that Sam Cooke was from Clarksville.
You know, I knew Sam, but I never knew he was from Clarksville.
Yes, he was from Clarksville, Mississippi, because he's one of my favorite singers. And
yeah, well, I know now that he was from Clarksville, but back in those days when he was alive, I wish I had known. I didn't know he was from home. Had no idea. But he ain't the only one. Muddy Waters, John Lee Hooker, you name them. Everybody's from down there.
Oh my God. So when did you realize that music was your passion? You know, because that was, our talents, once we, you know, because I'm a singer. And when I discovered that at the age of 13 that I had this operatic type voice, that gift carried me right on, you know, from singing in Memphis at a private club, you know, white folks, you know, and then through Memphis State for my voice lessons, and then that's how I ended up, going to college, Arkansas A&M College, and then Tougaloo, where, you know, we made history as a Tougaloo Nine. But it was that gift that paved the way for me to actually to have gotten out of that Jim Crow social system. And that's why I can relate to, you know, to you, you know, in terms of music. How did that come about? How did you realize that music spoke to you, you know?
You wouldn't believe it. I never even thought about nothing like that until the first day I went to high school.
In L.A.?
In L.A., the first day I went to high school, and I sit down to eat lunch at an outdoor counter, and I heard a sound like I'd never heard anything like it before. And it was so beautiful. So I wrapped them food up, and I went in search of it, and it kept stopping, so I had to stop and wait till it started again. Eventually, I got around behind this bungalow. There were four brothers back there with their lips protruding in each other's face, singing four-part harmony. Man, that was the most beautiful thing I could have ever bumped into. So after that, I went back every day at lunchtime because that's where they rehearsed. They had a little crowd to come back there with them. And after a while, I got
They were singing doo-wop, right?
Yeah, after a while I got to thinking, damn, I need to be a part of this. So So you know who Jesse Belvin is?
Who?
Jesse Belvin.
No, I don't know him.
All right, best thing ever happened in this town is a sin. They don't play his music, and they never play his music.
Yeah.
He's the one that got us all started in this business. But I heard one of his records. I called him up on the phone, and I finally got him. And I said, "Mr. Belvin, I want to sing, and I want to sound just like you." And he gave me the best piece of advice. Gave me the best advice anybody ever gave me. He said, "Get your own style, boy, and leave mine the F alone." So, but you know, since I told him,
did you take his advice?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. So he took me under his wing and taught me the business. And within a year's time, I had never sang before. I had my first hit record.
Oh, wow. Well, how did you finally become, you know, the artist and repertoire
well,
manager?
I wasn't a manager. I was an A&R man for a record company. What happened is that that first record they put out, first it was going to come out with just my name, Lil Charlie Wright, but the disc jockey that discovered it and wanted to put a group's name on it, so they called it the Twilighters. So I got involved with the group. Then that group broke up. I got involved with another group, had a huge record called You Cheated. The group name was The Shields. And
okay.
After that, I got involved with another group called The Galahads. And we were doing fine, but Alan Freed screwed us up. Anyway, when Alan Freed did that, the guy that ran the record company, I guess he saw something in me that I hadn't seen, because I was just a doo-wop singer. He asked me to stay on as an A&R director, because the guy named Bruce Johnson before me had just messed up. He was the A&R director. He really messed up something real bad, so he left and joined the Beach Boys, and I took his job. And that's when I produced Oldie But Goodies, Remind Me of You, which was a huge record. And I got screwed out of that money. So I ended up producing records around here on other people and playing guitar as a studio musician. I learned how to play the guitar, left in it, and I became...
Were you self-taught in learning how to play guitar?
Yeah,
how old were you, Mr. Wright, at that time?
18 when I started, and by the time I got to be 24, people wouldn't do a session without me around here. I was that popular as a studio musician. Should have stayed in there, but I wanted to be a star, so ended up doing this watch band thing, and it was great until... we start singing about stuff that bring people together and saving black folks, and then they somehow rooted inside my group and just tore us apart.
Well, you know, actually, in talking with you, Mr. Wright, you appear to have also been a civil rights activist in your own history.
In
listening to you talk, you know what I mean? I can feel that activism, coming, from you, your energy,
That's what got me in trouble, Brother Jackson. I have a song that should be heard. everybody should hear the song and probably adhere to it, but it really is a little too strong for white folks, I think. It's been done by a couple of white groups. It's been done by Les McCann, by Della Reese, by Ray Charles, and myself.
Oh, what?
It's called Comment. It's probably one of my most prolific songs, but it's never been a hit because they won't let it be heard. And I frankly think I've been punished for recording and Express Yourself. But it's so strong, you know, it just keeps going. It's not in 50 commercials now. It's in over 80 commercials and 30-some-odd movies.
Well, you know, before we went on the air, I played Express Yourself and listened to the lyrics.
Yeah.
And it's all about when you said you don't need any help. All you have to do is express yourself, and be who you are. And I heard activism, social activism, in the lyrics of Express Yourself.
I suppose you do, you know. It ain't nothing against anybody. It's just for something to lift us all up to be who we really are. We don't know who we are. We got television telling us every day that we ain't nothing. We got the movies telling us that we are bad. Everything bad that come on the screen is usually dark. The color is black or blue or green is dark. And it's the music goes boom, and it just, you know, we're being programmed. The KKK's in Hollywood. You know, we're being programmed to hate ourselves, and other people are being programmed to hate us as well. But that's where it started. They were being programmed to hate us. They found out it works on us, too. We hate ourselves. It's sad. And I'm looking at all these commercials today. They got black women with white men, most all of them. I can't believe it. Little black girls with white men. It's just getting to be terrible, and we're not doing nothing. We have no defense.
So right.
Yeah, that worries me. You know.
Well, you should be worried, because I think the same way that you are thinking. It just, you know, with me, you know, I just can't help not but to study black history. And sometimes, even when I was in the probation department, and the system was locking up nothing but black and brown juveniles.
Yeah.
And coming out of Memphis, I saw the bigotry and the racism in the criminal justice system when it came to children of color. And I still,
yeah.
Hold that thought right there, Mr. Jackson, because that's another subject that I want you to open up after we listen to Mr. Charles Wright's recording Comment, If All Men Were Truly Brothers, right here on Tribe Family Channel, Voices of Wisdom.
What is a man without a friend? We all live within a game. The word excuse has many names. true friends rarely come. Can't afford to lose one. Jealousy, as I recall, always been a man's hardest fall. Conquer fear, oh, it's quite a quest. Till we do, never rest. Child was born yesterday. Nothing but an inner space. Somebody's soul, a bit of seed. Can he grow a bit of weed? Listen, society, how can you see? I wanna know. You don't practice. See if we can get everybody to say it this evening. Call me a true
Wow, that was so deep, so beautiful. And what did he say? How many friends do you truly have? Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back live on Voices of Wisdom, hosted by the civil rights activist, the Tougaloo Nine, Mr. Joseph Jackson Jr., in discussion with our guest, Mr. Charles Wright, founder of the Watts 103rd Street Rhythm Band and author of Up From Where We've Come. I'm Beverly Black, and I'm instead for Mrs. Geraldine Hollis, who is traveling. They both get quite a few speaking engagements as the Tougaloo Nine and the civil rights activists, historically known for integrating the public library system. So if you want to reach out and get in touch with them, they are both on Facebook. Mrs. Geraldine Hollis, you will find her under Author Geraldine Hollis. You can go to her website, Mississippi, let me get it right before I even go there. I'll have that website in a minute, and if I don't, I'll open her line and ask her for it. But what did you think about that song? What back to Mississippi? Back to Mississippi. It just came to me.
Oh,
I believe.
Oh, okay.
And then Mr. Charles Wright is ExpressYourself.net, right?
Yes, and you know what I find
interesting.
Is when that song about the end of the first verse, I heard someone on the phone say, mute it.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. That was, that was me muting your line. That's the studio letting you know that your line had been muted. So that way, if you wanted to cough or do anything or go get a drink of water, I mute my line too. So that's just letting you know that I muted your line. No,
okay.
You thinking they still shutting down the song, huh?
they do that.
No, I closed the line and he heard muted and he said, they ain't gonna let it play on this show either. No, that was a very deep song. Tell us your passion behind writing that song. If you are the writer, I know you performed it so eloquently and so passionately, but tell us how the derivative of the song's content and, you really have some very profound points all throughout that song. But one of the final points that I took away was at the end when it was saying, with all the riches and everything that you have, how many friends can you really say that you have? So that was very profound right there, family and friends over things.
Well, actually, excuse me for butting in. What is the is that record on the market, Mr. Wright?
Yeah, I put it out in 1968, I think, or 9. And,
Lord,
okay,
I was 9 years old.
And the title of the song is what?
Comment. I actually shouldn't have named it that. I should have called it something else. Because people didn't know what to ask for at the store, so I think that's part of the reason that it didn't go. But another part of the reason was that I think the company turned against me after I did that song, which is
Comment. That's the name.
Comment.
Of it.
C-O-M-M-E-N-T.
Yeah. Okay. Because I have this modern technology, with Alexa, and all I have to do, I've got Music Unlimited on this technology through Amazon, and so I'm going to ask her to play that for me after we get off of the air, because that song actually should be playing now there at the White House, and I'm not political, but where we are now with regards to the division within our United States and the polarization, this song should be really a bestseller right now. So that's why I wanted to get that inspirational notation to you. Yeah, I was moved.
Thank you.
I was moved too. Yeah, I was really moved too. And I echo Mr. Jackson's sentiments, Mr. Wright, because we are in a place where I've never seen this place in my, I'm 60 years old, so when you gentlemen were hitting the stages and the colleges and stuff, you know, I was born in 59, so you were just heading into your, you know, young, sowing your wild oats at my coming into the world. And I, you know, have followed history, and in my 60 years, I have never, ever, 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 ever seen such disdainable behavior, such reprehensible, you know, batting of the, just such a disrespect to all the borders and parameters of any type of humane and respect. And see, one thing we're forgetting about, people not, they don't have their eyes on the immigrants in those encampments and all locked up in those cages. People still dying, people right. still suffering, but everything is so focused now, and now we're at war. We are basically at war. We're just not the ones fighting yet. But you can best believe, since the allies have been upset like this at the drop of a hat and a call from an adversary, you know, because you being puppeteered by Putin, you owe Putin so much that you got to do what he say for Ukraine to take down those forces at the drop of a hat. Think about the story behind the story. Okay, the story behind the story is Trump and his family are owned by Russia and Putin, and all the money funneled therein, okay? And they got so many other deals with so many other entities of corruption, and but they have just arrested a couple of Giuliani's imps, and, you know, the walls are going to come crumbling down, and I see why it has to take time, you know, but we're going to get back to the show, but I see why things have to take time. If you want something to really come to its full flavor, you got to let that thing cook slow. Now, that's Southern for you. Back to y'all conversation.
And Mr. Wright, when did you pin the lyrics to that song? Was that, you said 68 or 69?
Yes, that's when I put it out. I wrote it about 67.
See, and actually the following year was when the King of Love was assassinated. So you were in that energy field while you were pinning the lyrics to that song. Because it had a lot to do with the activism of the 60s. And you felt that.
Yes, sir. It has to do
And that's what I heard. And so, you know, when this show ends, I mean, I'm just really inspired because there's a lot of things that I want to discuss with you. So if you could... later on, ask Ms. Black to give you my telephone number, my brother. There are a lot of other questions that I would like to ask you and to get to know you better, because we have a lot in common, really.
And you have the same area code, so you must not be that far from each other. But it's going to be my honor to I'll send you his number and vice versa, because I do believe that it is imperative for him to know the depth and the measure of your story. And Mr. Wright, Mr. Jackson will require the audio book. He is sight challenged. You know, he's been here circling this earth 80 some odd years fighting in the civil rights era and beyond. And so in order for him to enjoy up from where we've come, he would need the audio version. Is it available?
No. I will. It will be available next year, but it's not available right now.
Oh, that's wonderful. 2020 is the year for the audio version of Up From Where We've Come. That's going to be a good year. Oh, that's going to be a real good year. Amen, amen. That's what I like, though. You know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's something I want to
deal with. No, because you release books in progression. You don't release everything all at once. You don't release the paperback with the ebook, with the audio. So when you release it in different segments, then you market that particular section. So I'm holding an autographed copy of your paperback book, and I'm just going to turn it to any page. As we get ready to get out of here, I'm going to just read a little bit and just to give our listening audience a little teaser. This is chapter 16, From the Graveyard to the Corn Patch. In preparation for an orderly stroll to Grandma's house, Mom gathered the children and calmed us as best she could, then instructed the older ones to keep an eye out for the younger children. Before we left, however, Bill's brother Clyde showed up on a restless mule. He was older than Bill, but they'd enjoyed a close relationship. So, angry to the core, he asked, which way did the mother effer go? Now, you know it spells it all the way out, but it's clear. The sheer look in his eyes frightened us out of our wits, yet no one said a word. His reputation was that of a mild-mannered teen who'd always respected his elders, and no one had ever seen brandish a weapon. Yet, somebody tell me, he begged gripping a rifle. Which way did the mother effer? Which way the mother effer went? That's the South, right? Sadie Mae out loud tried to talk him out of his obvious intentions, but hell no. I'm going to F him up the moment I get a head on him. So somebody tell me which way the mother effer went. I'm sorry, said mother, but I don't think you understand. This was an accident, Clyde. You know my children wouldn't do such a thing on purpose. Then she raised her head toward the sky and said, please, Lord, endow this child with the proper understanding and allow my child to come out of this alive. Now, that's a praying woman, and you have got to get up from where we've come. This is trying to get out of the deep, dark sharecropper South, and that was just what they were speaking of, Mr. Charles Wright's mother getting them out of there. Mr. Charles Wright, you have been nothing more than a blessing in my life. You have accommodated the music side of Tribe Family Channel with Soul School Music with Marshall Thompson. You have embellished us here. You have been on Criminalized by Color. We are going to get you on a couple of other shows. The young lady that you met in LA at Michael Henderson's show. And I wanted to bring up Mr. Wright was sure right about you don't come to L.A. without saluting the funk. Michael Henderson came up there all the way from Atlanta, and I was trying to get in touch with Mr. Charles Wright. He already at the show, okay? I'm wasting my time. You think somebody going to come to L.A. and not honor this man, the founder of funk? That's unheard of. And so I was honored that we were able to send one of our sister stations, Michelle Berard, to see you, Mr. Wright. And we're going to have you interview on her show as well. We're going to make the circuit with Up From Where We've Come. So, ladies and gentlemen, live on Voices of Wisdom, hosted by the civil rights activist, the Tougaloo Nine. I'm Beverly Black, instead for Mrs. Geraldine Hollis, away traveling on her speaking engagements, and Mr. Joseph Jackson Jr., the leader of the Tougaloo Nine, trained by the other seven, by Megger Evers, along with the foot soldiers, and they integrated the library system in Jackson, Mississippi, which ultimately would spread throughout and was a pivotal moment where they risked their lives. Mr. Jackson was a young husband and a father. And he out there on a music scholarship. Mr. Jackson, Mr. Wright, 23 years old. And Mr. Wright, what you don't know about Mr. Jackson is that he has a background in music. His scholarship to the college was a music scholarship. Tell us a little bit about that before we close out this show, Mr. Jackson.
Well, actually, I won't take long, but I want to leave this with Mr. Wright with regards to the city of Clarksville. I was 10 or 11 years old. My grandparents lived in Belzoni, Mississippi, and my mother would take me during the summer to visit them. Well, when we got to Clarksville on our way back to Memphis, we was on a Greyhound bus, and we went in and we had food and drink. But before we boarded the Greyhound bus again there in Clarksville, Mr. Wright, this fat bus driver turns around and hits my mother in the face and knocks her down on the gravel. And when I turned my mother over, her face was bloodied. And so that was what started me really wanting to do something about the Jim Crow system. And so getting back to, you know, Tougaloo, I didn't know where Mississippi was, but as a result of a law scholarship and also being an ordained minister, I went to Tougaloo the fall of 1960, and the spring of 61, that was when I met Matt Evans and my eight colleagues, and we staged the first lead-in in the city of Jackson. That's how it all happened. I'm saying it was just divine intervention then, and it's divine intervention now in terms of meeting you. After listening to your music, express yourself. When I was a counselor in juvenile hall, and now, after the show is over, I'm going to come back and listen to comment. And so when your audio book comes out, Lord willing, you know, I have glaucoma right now, and I'm 82 years old. And I'm still just as active with regards to social justice as you are. And I feel your spirit, and I thank you for your presentation with regard to sharing your story.
Thank you. I mean, I'm glad to talk to somebody from home in the first place. Before we get off here, I'd like to plead to everybody to please try to introduce your children to authentic blues music. This is something we created that's great, that we've abandoned and let other people take away from us. We cannot afford to do that. That's why we're listening to so much junk today that we should not, our children should not be hearing. Hello?
Yes. Black?
You're right about it. You're right about it. No, you are absolutely right about it. And I just want to, again, thank you for taking out the time, both of you gentlemen, for being here, for allowing me to connect your voices together. This is divine connection, and that's what it's about. Voices of Wisdom on Tribe Family Channel is so named to keep the voice of Rachel Berry alive through our platform. She created the group Voices of Wisdom because everyone knows something that someone else needs to know, officially known as the Vow Network on Facebook. So you can go to the Facebook.com/groups/ the Voices of Wisdom Network. And you can also listen to the archives of this show at blogtalkradio.com for / Gumbo for the Soul. I'm Beverly Black. I am the creator of Tribe Family Channel at Gumbo for the Soul International Family Brand, and our parent company is GumboForTheSoulInternational.com. Again, I want to thank you both for your time, for your activism, for paving the way so that I could be here doing what I'm doing today. And it's a pleasure and an honor and a privilege. I'll make sure that you have each other's phone numbers. Enjoy the rest of your evening. Stay focused, stay conscious, stay blessed, stay woke. Good night and God bless.
Y'all hear me out. Express yourself. Come on, y'all. Express yourself. Express yourself. Express yourself. Express yourself.
blame it on the happiness. Money, we made it. Yeah, but before we see it, are they taking? Yes, it make you wanna holler at them. The way they do your life. Make you wanna holler at them. Inflation means there ain't no chance, and to increase a little bit of finance, and bills they're gonna pile up the sky. Just send that boy off to die. Yes, make him wanna holler at him the way they do your life. Make him wanna holler at him.
Happy for